Chapter 3. Who are they? Who are we? Where does life on our planet come from? I understood it when I was in high school. Life arose in the so-called primordial soup, as proved by the famous experiments of Stanley Miller, 1930 to 2007, and Harold Urey, 1893 to 1981. In 1953, Miller, still a student at the University of California in Berkeley, started an experiment that had been suggested to him by his professor, Harold Urey. Miller and Urey introduced methane, water vapor, ammonia, carbon dioxide, and various minerals that existed billions of years ago on Earth into a sterile glass flask. Electrical sparks were fired into the experiment, and a week later the first results were evident. Organic compounds were created, as well as amino acids, all of them the building blocks of life. The period in which a nutrient solution for primitive life could form out of the primordial soup is set by science at about 1.2 billion years. A few million years either way are neither here nor there. The Miller experiments were repeated several times under different conditions with varying results. It has generally been assumed since Stanley Miller that life has arisen by itself, and all the more so as Stanley Miller received the backing of outstanding thinkers. The chemist Jacques Monod, former director of research in cell biology at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, wrote, "The old bond has broken. Human beings finally know that they are alone in the indifferent expanses of the universe from which they emerged by accident." And Professor Manfred Eigen, equally a Nobel Prize winner like his French colleague Jacques Monod, predicted as long ago as 1975, "It will be possible to reproduce every living creature artificially out of its natural genetic material, that is, by other than natural means." He was right. Today, life forms are created by non-natural means. It is, however, done from the natural genetic material. The physicist Jeremy England goes even further. He is convinced that every group of atoms would organize itself without external cause, that is, without lightning or electromagnetic waves. That would turn life into a logical sequence of physical laws. Coincidence would be right out of the window, and the universe should be teeming with life, because all matter consists of groups of atoms, and they organize themselves, according to Jeremy England. Yet Jacques Monod contradicts this fascinating thought. He postulated, after all, that human beings were alone in the expanses of the universe from which they emerged by accident. All in all, this is a picture that satisfied most scientists. It is the current orthodox view, multiplied a million times, and set in concrete in all textbooks. Yet it is controversial. Atoms combine to form molecules, but collections of molecules are not life that propagates. In the long chain of chemical evolution, the cell is the first, simplest life form. For that to arise, all the ingredients have to be present: amino acids, nucleic acids, formed from chains of nucleotides, and the basic building blocks adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. These form the famous double-stranded structure of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, the double helix, and so on. I don't want to bore my readers by writing a chapter about the chemical building blocks. The fact remains that in the first cell, which arose in the primordial soup, the complex molecular chain had to combine in the correctly matching way. A random collection of molecules, which happen to stick together, is not enough to form a cell. Neither is it any help to make the reciprocal magnetic effects that happen to exist on Earth responsible. A lock consists of a lock and a key, and the key has to fit into the lock. Only specific bases fit into the sequence of the double helix, DNA. Other basic building blocks cannot dock. And that raises the question, why does it only work like this and not in any other way? Is there another program right from the beginning behind DNA or the innumerable other building blocks of life? Quite clearly, they can only bond in a specific way. Specified by what? Or perhaps whom? Does something like spirit in matter exist, as the physicist Jean Charon put it? Does what happens on Earth happen in the same way on other Earth-like planets? And on Jupiter-like planets, a different program is running that in turn only works there. Chemical evolution, as I have just touched on it, is a firm part of our scientific thinking. Yet science is something living. Ways of looking at things other than what happens to be the dominant diktat force us to ask new questions, and there are indeed a number of clouds on the horizon. The doubts already began to surface 44 years ago. At that time, the mathematician James Coppedge asked himself what the probability was that the chains of molecules would dock in the right position. After all, nothing happened in an orderly or indeed peaceful way in the primordial soup. It was fizzing, burning, and boiling. Toxic vapors dissolved everything again that might have come together. Mr. Coppedge played the following game. Our alphabet consists of 26 letters. If we wrote them on small cards, put them in a drum, and thoroughly mixed them up, the chance of fishing out the A would lie at 1 in 26. The word evolution consists of 9 letters in a specific order. The probability of fishing these 9 letters out of the drum in the correct sequence lies at 1 to 5,429,503,678,976. Mr. Coppedge carried the game to extremes. He took the 3 words, evolution is impossible, as the subject of his calculations. The words consist of 21 letters and 2 spaces between the words. The chance of drawing the right letters in the right sequence out of the drum lies at 1 to 8,433,900,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, letters out of the machine each second. In order to compose the words, "Evolution is impossible," this utopian machine would have to rattle along for 26 quintillion years. "That is all nonsense," the critics replied. "Chemical evolution was not governed by the principle of chance, but by necessary forms. Jacques Monod's chance and necessity. Millions of molecules were swirling about in the primordial soup and would have to find themselves precisely where lock and key fitted together. This, in the opinion of the Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod, happens of necessity. Today we say, without any alternative. Yet the permanent production of amino acids into enzymes and ultimately into proteins contradicts not only one, but two concrete laws of physics, the law of mass action and the law of entropy. Immense quantities of water opposed the microscopic amino acid particles. Here it should not be forgotten that amino acids are not living things. They cannot reproduce like cells, for example. Now, the smallest living unit consists of at least 239 protein molecules. But a protein molecule itself is made up of 20 different amino acids and complex enzymes. To bring this confusing subject to a conclusion, the primordial soup, the primordial atmosphere in which this chemical game was played out, has no connection whatsoever with our atmosphere we breathe today. That primordial soup consisted primarily of methane and ammonia. Oxygen would have acted in this atmosphere like poison. If the first cells had been created in a methane-ammonia atmosphere, they would have been immediately killed off again by the addition of oxygen. Furthermore, all reactions leading to the formation of proteins are reversible. Chemicals forming by chance can dissolve again just as quickly. It has been proposed that the proteins did not form in the chaos of the primordial soup, but on the edges of craters. It was hot there. The proteins would have been destroyed. The technical debate about chemical evolution rages unabated. I have only briefly indicated the contradictions. In 1973, Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel, co-discoverers of the double helix structure of DNA, published an explosive article in the scientific journal Icarus entitled Directed Panspermia. In it, they postulate that an unknown alien intelligence had ensured that life in the universe would arise everywhere according to the same blueprint. The aliens had sent out a spaceship with various microorganisms. A payload of 1,000 kilograms might be made up of 10 samples, each containing 10 to the 16th microorganisms, or 100 samples each of 10 to the 15th microorganisms. It would not be necessary to accelerate the spaceship to extremely high velocities, since its time of arrival would not be important. The radius of our galaxy is about 10 to the 5th light years, so we could infect most planets in the galaxy within 10 to the 8th years by means of a spaceship, traveling at only 1,000th of the velocity of light. Several thousand stars are within 100 light years of the Earth, and could be reached within as little as 1,000,000 years by a spaceship traveling at only 60,000 miles per hour, or within 10,000 years if a speed of 1/100th of that of light were possible. Crick and Orgel thus shift the origin of life to a distant world. But there the same problems had to be overcome as with us. This problem preoccupied the Swedish physicist and Nobel Prize winner Svante Arrhenius, 1859 to 1927, as long as 80 years ago. Somewhere, he writes, life must have started, and he postulates that life was eternal, thereby avoiding the question about its origin. Of course, even a circular line had to start somewhere, but as soon as the circle was closed, the question as to its beginning no longer arose. It could no longer be answered. Behind the start, some kind of creation, or what the religions describe as God, had to be assumed. Why can the start of the circle not have been the Earth? Because it simply does not work chronologically. This has been clearly shown by the astrophysicists Sir Fred Hoyle, the mathematics genius Chandra Vikramasinghe, and the Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick. Their works are full of mathematical equations that all lead to the same conclusion. Life did not arise on Earth because the time for its development, with the myriad coincidences needed for the creation of the molecular chains, was in no instance enough. In the summer of 1980, a scientific congress at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem concerned itself with the question, "Did Adam come from space?" This is Professor Volman on the subject. We know from chemical analyses that the fundamental building blocks of life are chemical compounds with monster molecules. Each of these molecules consists of several hundred thousand to millions of atoms. We call these chemical substances polymers. We think that the basic substances from which nature created the first polymers did not come from Earth, but from space. These arguments should actually be enough. Life did not start with us. One competent crown witness is still missing. Professor Bruno Vollmert, 1920 to 2002. Vollmert was professor of molecular chemistry at the University of Karlsruhe. He concerned himself intensively both with chemical and Darwinian evolution. At the end of his many years of research, he admitted, "DNA, and thus life, could not arise by itself. But since, on the other hand, life has always clearly been there, so that also pieces of DNA, genes, can be analyzed and recreated at any time in the laboratory, it must either always have existed, which is not the case, or it owes its existence to intelligent, purposeful planning, is the result of planned design." Vollmert displayed moral courage. He accused his colleagues of ideological motives and slew them with precise calculations. The probability of realizing 1 of 10 assumed intermediate stages to be on the safe side of the growth curve of DNA through statistical copolymerization on the path to a new class of living creature is 1 in 10 to the power of 4,000. The only honest interpretation of this probability is that Darwin's theory of the origin of species and life as such through mutation and selection was, and is, a big misapprehension. Chandra Vikramasinghe, holder of several doctorates, is currently the director of the Buckingham Centre for Astrobiology of the University of Buckingham in England. He is considered to be a mathematical genius and has received honors worldwide in the field of mathematics. At a congress in Sindelfingen Town Hall in the spring of 2015, he analyzed the impossibility of chemical evolution in front of an audience of 3,000 people. He told me personally at dinner, "You can forget the story with the primordial soup. It was a good thought, but total nonsense." With such an accumulation of scholarly statements, all of them made by top scientists, we have to ask ourselves, why does the old doctrine still apply? Why are students in high schools and universities not taught the two different opinions? The motive is what it has always been: ideology. The one group denies both God and extraterrestrials. In its eyes, we human beings are the only ones in the universe. The faithful in all religions have been taught that we are the crown of creation. Students of science, that we are the pinnacle of evolution. In both cases, be it religion or science, there is only one valid insight. We are the greatest. A being like God has, in any case, been abolished for a long time. It never fit in with human self-importance. Chemical evolution did not take place on Earth. Period. The building blocks of life came from outside. Who sent them? Are those legendary forefathers the same who visited the Earth thousands of years ago, or the descendants of those forefathers? The same who show themselves through UFOs, who kidnap individual people and create marvelous pictures in the corn and wheat fields. And if it is them, what is it all about? What do they get out of it? And what about Darwinian evolution? Darwin's evolutionary theory is the credo of anthropology. In scientific circles, it is downright sacrilegious not to believe in it. Everyone who doubts Darwin's theory is an ignorant bore who can be ignored. Yet hardly a year passes without another press conference at which even more recent discoveries about the human race are announced. The fossil concerned is then deemed to be the most recent prehistoric human being, until the next event of this kind. All life forms develop from genes. What actually is such a gene? Professor Beta Stadler, geneticist at the University of Bern, explains it. Genes can be described as precisely defined sections of DNA which represent the blueprint for RNA molecules from which proteins are created. All genes together are called the genome. In higher living organisms, the genome exists in several strings which are packaged separately and are called chromosomes. All chromosomes, in turn, are packaged in the cell nucleus. In human beings, the whole set of chromosomes in each nucleated cell consists of 46 chromosomes, whereby 23 come from the mother and 23 from the father. Clear? The genetic code is the key to every life form. Anyone who knows this code can manipulate any living creature as they like by changing the basic sequence in the DNA spiral. The whole thing started in 1973, when the biologists Stanley Cohen and Herbert Boyer succeeded for the first time in implanting a foreign gene into a bacterium. Today, it is commonplace. Every geneticist knows how it is done. At the time of our grandfathers, it was still grafting. Certain characteristics of a plant are transferred to another one. Such things are everyday occurrences for biologists, and no one gets excited about them. In genetics, the procedure is different. The nucleus of a cell is stripped out, and the chemical building blocks in the DNA string, the double helix, are moved to another location in the string and reintroduced into the cell. But beforehand, the geneticist must know where he wants to change what, and what the result should be. The cell nucleus can also be removed and implanted in the cell of another living organism. That procedure is called cloning, and is always done with cells of the same animal species. Dolly the sheep was created in this way in 1997, a 100% copy of the donor animal. Dolly has long since given birth to healthy offspring. Then, in the spring of 2008, the British government permitted the creation of hybrid creatures, so-called chimeras. Here, the nucleus is taken from the cells of different living organisms, a cow and a human being, for example, and the human cell nucleus injected into the empty cell of the cow. A short electrical impulse stimulates the cell to divide, and the cow cell multiplies with the genetic information of the human being. Insane? Nature has done this for millions of years, without human intervention. A so-called retrovirus, such as the AIDS virus, penetrates a cell, copies its own genetic information, and multiplies. The Australian geneticist Andrew Pask, from the University of Melbourne, implanted the genome of a Tasmanian tiger into a mouse embryo and got the cells to multiply. Similar experiments are being undertaken worldwide. The aim is genetic modification, superficially the improvement of human beings. Defects such as Alzheimer's or multiple sclerosis are to be eradicated through such therapeutic cloning. As long ago as 1987, Japanese geneticists developed a so-called super sequencer, which daily decoded a million letters of DNA. That was just the beginning. The U.S. geneticist Craig Venter wanted to reveal the transparent human being, that is, the complete human genome. He has, meanwhile, succeeded in doing so, with some complications. In his most recent bombshell, Craig Venter announced that his scientific team had developed a miniature life form. In other words, a living thing, made by human beings. Uncanny. The life form consists of 531,560 letters of DNA and is designated SYN 3.0. Although this synthetic thing is alive, Craig Venter does not know why either. More than 480 genes were implanted, others were removed. Until a few months ago, I write these words in the summer of 2016, such artificial modifications to the human genome were considered to be a highly complex laboratory act. Swapping individual genes could take months, and furthermore, was very expensive. Meanwhile, everything has become simple. Kathy Neacon, geneticist at the London Francis Crick Institute, the French microbiologists Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna developed a new method of modifying the genome with pinpoint accuracy. The procedure is called CRISPR-Cas9 technique. What is almost like a molecular pair of scissors made of the protein Cas9 is used, which, similar to a virus, cuts through the DNA string at precisely the desired place. It is a surgical procedure on the genome. Genome editing. CRISPR works like child's play. The German news magazine Der Spiegel quotes the German geneticist Rudolf Jenisch. People who have no idea about what happens inside a cell rant about genetically modified food and warn with a wagging finger against everything connected with genetics. They don't know that the enzymes in quite ordinary washing powders were cooked up in the genetic kitchen, just like lecithin, which occurs in hundreds of foodstuffs. It comes from genetically modified soybeans. The same applies to the glucose syrup that is added to all kinds of drinks. To make glucose syrup, an enzyme is required, which today comes almost exclusively from genetically modified organisms. And now we have the CRISPR-Cas9 technique. With this genetic weapon, the targeted control of evolution becomes a fact, anytime, be it in the past or the future. Animals, humans, and anything else growing on Earth can be modified quickly and easily. Presumably, the ETs have mastered not just the CRISPR procedure, but even more sophisticated methods of artificially mutating life forms. Did they do that? Can rifts or completely paradoxical modifications be shown in biological evolution that cannot be explained by natural means? Was Charles Darwin, with his Origin of the Species, fundamentally right, but not always? After all, he couldn't, at his time, know about the genetic code, much less about artificial mutations. There are indeed living creatures on our blue planet whose existence raises huge questions. For example, 4,000 meters down in the deep ocean, where luminous monsters developed in absolute darkness, including a creature called a pistol shrimp, which does away with its opponents using boiling hot water. Or the Iskinochiton, a primitive sea animal that has a carapace made of 8 superimposed plates. On the upper plate, there are hundreds of tiny eyes hidden in small hollows. In this way, the animal can see everything in its surroundings. Each tiny eye has its own sensory organ, a total contradiction to evolution. Even more fantastical, there are species of beetles with weapons that could not have arisen by natural means. One is of a very special kind, the bombardier beetle. They frighten or kill their enemies with a highly toxic secretion that sprays out from a combustion chamber in the abdomen at about 100 degrees Celsius. This secretion consists of the chemicals hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide, with the addition of the enzymes catalase and peroxidase. A catalyst is created that mixes the chemicals into toxic benzoquinone, detonating gas. This detonating gas explodes and sprays at its target out of the body of the bombardier beetle. It does so at a temperature of 100 degrees Celsius. In the whole process, the chemicals involved enter the combustion chamber through a very thin valve. After each explosion, the chamber is closed with a flap, which opens again for the next explosion. 2 tiny reflectors, one on each side, enable the bombardier beetle to shoot round corners. It kills not just small attackers, but also toads, which are 100 times bigger. How is this weapon in the body of the beetle supposed to have developed slowly? The wall of the combustion chamber consists of a resistant coating of proteins and chitin. The toxic mixture shoots out of a controllable spray gland in the abdomen. The reflectors can guide the poisonous jet around corners. How are the chemical components supposed to have developed in the body, slowly, from generation to generation? Did the combustion chamber already exist, or was it created later on? The controllable jet. The reflectors. Did everything develop at the same time, willy-nilly, in a beetle family? And the combustion chamber, with its 2 valves, it must already have been present when the chemical developed, however that may have happened. Otherwise, the beetle itself would have exploded when the chemicals mixed. Evolution cut short. And the tiny flap that opens rapidly before each deadly shot and immediately closes again. And then there is still the beetle's brain. Coupled with its sensory organs, the chemicals have to be instructed to mix now at lightning speed when an enemy appears, and the firing gland must be pointed at the opponent like a gun barrel. Then the command to fire. All a bit hard to swallow. Through which commands, which spirits, are the individual parts of this weapon supposed to have come together? Did the beetle tell its body, I need a combustion chamber, a jet, a gun flap that opens and closes at lightning speed, 2 external reflectors made of very durable material? After all, they not only have to stand the acids, but also 100-degree temperatures. A slow development extending over generations does not work here. Now, I am not of the opinion that some gods somewhere had interfered with the beetle genome and created the beetle's weapons. But I think it is conceivable that the beetle was imported from an alien world. Even if it was not in a completely finished state, then at least its genome, similar to snakes or rats that get to remote islands on ships. The beetle is tiny. The whale, huge. Every school student learns that whales are mammals and originally lived on the land. That also applies to other marine mammals. So at some point in its development, the original whale must have plopped into the water. Perhaps it also waddled in unhurriedly because it became too hot outside. Then it loses its feet, forms flippers, mates underwater, and also suckles its young in the wet element. Where have the hydraulics of the extendable underwater nipples come from? They must have been there from the beginning, otherwise the juvenile would have perished immediately after birth. And in general, the question applies. If all of this was of benefit to the life form concerned, survival of the fittest, why did others of the same species not do the same? There is no dispute. Mutation, changes, constantly takes place within a species. I read somewhere that there are said to be 1,000 different species of spiders. All of them are related to one another and have a common spider ancestor. And the latter, in turn, has descended from I know not what miniature monster. But a spider will not turn into a cow, not after hundreds of millions of years. The first vertebrates are said to have emerged from worm species, and at some point a living clump of cells mutated into a crab. This now has to mate to continue the evolutionary chain. With whom should he mate? Did the random mutation that created the crab affect a whole horde? We mammals are said to have originated from bony fish. The fish mutated and the swim bladder could no longer obtain oxygen from the water, but from the air. The lung was born. From these coelacanths, it was only a small step to the first amphibian. Great! And what did this amphibian get up to in its endless solitude? It developed into a crawler, a mammal, and so on. They now laid their eggs on dry land. At some point, the first reptile developed, which could, however, no longer pair with its relative, the amphibians. New fellow creatures of the same species with the same number of chromosomes were required, and they were, what a surprise, suddenly available. What is the origin of these changes? The genes are responsible. They are the most important data medium. But they are only a small link in the complex and fascinating chains of life. There is no dispute that we are the closest relatives to the apes. Until a few years ago, it was said that our genes were 99% identical with those of the great apes. We had the same ancestors, the same skeleton, and the same protein structure. In the non-stop series of thousands and thousands of mutations over millions of years, quite a few things have changed from the ancestor of the apes to us. Only the proteins haven't. Comparatively, the differences between the protein forms of two frogs are 50 times greater than those between chimpanzees and humans. Professor Alan C. Wilson and his colleague Mary Claire King, both biochemists from the University of California, who showed these divergences in the proteins of frogs, say, there must be a hitherto undiscovered and much more effective evolutionary motor than we know of so far. Now, Dr. Marie-Laure Jaspo from the Max Planck Institute for Molecular Genetics in Berlin has informed the public that the differences between humans and chimpanzees were, after all, greater than thought. I quote, "So far, it has been assumed that humans and chimpanzees only differed slightly in their genome. But now a team of scientists from Germany, China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan has discovered in a direct comparison of the chimpanzee chromosome 22 and its human equivalent, chromosome 21, that in the human genome there were almost 68,000 insertions or deletions. While most of these changes have no or only a slight influence on the function of the coded proteins, the researchers nevertheless found in 20% of them significant structural differences. If these differences are extrapolated to the whole genome, apes and humans could differ in several thousand genes, which would better explain the differences between both species." The scientific findings are dynamite, and no one seems to notice. The evolutionary distance between humans and mice is said to be 60 million years. Between chimpanzees and humans, it is perhaps 2 or 3 million. Now, believe it or not, 68,000 longer differing segments were found in the genome between humans and chimpanzees. Yet this means that the amino acid sequence of the 231 discovered coded proteins in humans and apes varies by 83%. Why, who, or what caused this gigantic mutation? We are not talking about 50 or 100 random mutations in the genome, but 68,000. They were not inserted or deleted at random by nature, whatever that may be. The differences are targeted. What are we? Fundamentally, a product of evolution. But why are we so different from our genetically related apes? The primate researcher Franz Duval from Emory University in Atlanta thinks that language differentiates us fundamentally from the apes because human survival depends on it. According to this logic, we could not exist without language. No, say other scientists, it was our social behavior that constituted our humanity, as if a troop of gorillas, a school of dolphins, or a pride of lions did not possess any social behavior. We Are Bastards, Professor David Reich from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge tells us, the lines of humans and chimpanzees had already been divided the far side of Eden. Then, the two species had subsequently exchanged genes between one another again. After prehumans had already lived for hundreds of thousands of years as their own species, they suddenly started engaging in sexual intercourse with their knuckle-walking relatives again. Nothing is impossible. But why would an upright walking hominid suddenly spurn a fellow member of his species and have sex with a fur-covered ape? Furthermore, the product of such love would be a genetically retrograde step. The bastard would not have better genes, quite apart from the question as to whether the chromosomes of human and chimpanzee would be compatible in the first place. The heretical thoughts I put forward are not in principle directed against evolution. We are quite simply offshoots of apes, and all dumb cows are related to one another. A primordial mother spider probably exists somewhere, and all insects, the stinging and the harmless ones, are descended from a sticky conglomerate of cells. But I have good reason to reject the extraordinary amalgamation of species with the inexpressibly complex changes of the molecular chain. Scholars such as the Nobel Prize winner Sir Francis Crick, the astrophysicist Chandra Vikramasinghe, or Bruno Vollmert, professor of molecular chemistry, are neither amateurs nor idiots. Professor Oliver Muhlmann, University of Bern, a brilliant representative of biochemistry, writes, "How did life arise?" Plausible answers to this question, which is of such key importance for the way we see ourselves and our worldview, have been supplied in the last 200 years, above all by the sciences, with Charles Darwin leading the way with his simple and elegant evolutionary theory, which has been confirmed X thousandfold. It explains coherently how today's diversity of living creatures developed out of common, identical primordial cells. There is not the slightest doubt for the learned professor, neither about chemical nor Darwinian evolution, confirmed X thousandfold, it explains coherently. But why, then, does Professor Vollmert and others say the precise opposite? The cell owes its existence to intelligent, purposeful planning. Darwin's theory about the origin of species was and is a great misapprehension. All professors are upright, highly intelligent scholars, and yet they reach completely different views. And this is multiplied 100 times, because there are at least 100 book titles by thoroughly honest scientists against evolution. Important intellects among them, such as Dr. Thomas Nagel, currently professor of philosophy at the University of California, and those at Berkeley and Princeton. Professor Nagel uncovered a number of fundamental contradictions that argue against current evolutionary theory. Since then, he has been under fire from his colleagues. Why, oh why, do scientists who often went to the same schools fight one another so vehemently? The catchword is always ideology. The pro-Darwin faction is reviled as materialists, the opposing school dismissed as creationists who still believe in a God. Yet God means nothing at all to many who hold views against evolution. Opinions are entrenched and judgments have been made. Such behavior in science is no different to religion or ideology. The one side doesn't even bother to read the books of the other side. Each group insists that it is right, and each group looks with pity on the other, which simply refuses to see sense. The pioneer Craig Venter believed he had decoded the human genome, made the transparent human being visible. Then clever geneticists found that there is no generally valid genome, for genes do not just work by themselves. They are always active in association with hundreds of other genes. The idea that genes are lined up on a string like pearls is deceptive. All the genetic material contains overlapping information, confirms Dr. Roderic Guigou from the Center for Genome Regulation in Barcelona. And these busy researchers keep coming across things that are impossible, things that can be proved but should not exist. Such impossible things appear briefly, cause irritation, and are immediately dumped back in the chamber of forgetfulness. What kind of things? In 1960, several stone tools were found near Huehuetlaco, 120 kilometers southeast of Mexico City. They were dated by four different methods. 1. Uranium dating. 2. Fission track dating. 3. Tephra hydration, and 4. Mineral weathering. All methods produced an age of about 250,000 years. Impossible for the evolutionists. There could not be any human tools 250,000 years ago. Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson, both scientists, wrote in their thoroughly researched book, Forbidden Archaeology, "The problem lies much deeper than Huehuetlaco. It concerns the manipulation of scientific thinking through the suppression of puzzling data, data which call the currently prevailing way of thinking into question. Our work in Huehuetlaco was rejected by most archaeologists because it contradicts the theory. Their argumentation is circular. Homo sapiens sapiens developed in Eurasia about 30 to 50,000 years ago, hence it is impossible that there are tools which are 250,000 years old which can be traced back to Homo sapiens sapiens, since Homo sapiens sapiens did not arise until about 30,000 years ago, etc. Such a way of thinking produces self-satisfied scientists, but lousy science. Cremo and Thompson, the latter a mathematician at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, give several well-documented examples from the Pliocene, 5.3 to 2.5 million years ago, and the Miocene, which lines up to 23 million years in the past. They are always bones, objects which have no business in the period concerned, but clearly exist. At Bruniquel Cave in southern France, there is also a stone circle with a diameter of about 6 meters. It was dated by archaeologists from the University of Bordeaux to 176,000 years, definitively and unalterably. So someone acted purposefully 176,000 years ago. Neanderthals? And why? Things become even more confusing. Bones were found in a cave in the Altai Mountains, the borderland of Mongolia and Siberia, and analyzed at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. The clearly human bones from the Denisovan cave do not match the human genome. The genome of the Denisovan humans differs more than twice as much from the one of Homo sapiens than the one from Neanderthals. These are by no means isolated cases, but hundreds of contradictory findings that the one side chucks in the waste paper bin with irritation. As long as 40 years ago, and thereafter, I introduced a thought to the discussion, which is today becoming more and more realistic: specific, artificial, external mutation. The Christian world is generally familiar with the virgin birth. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is said to have conceived immaculately from the Holy Spirit. The story is not, of course, true, as I have also shown. But where does this idea of artificial insemination come from? In the Old Testament, such miracles are described in several places. The infertile women Sarah, Genesis chapter 18, verses 10 through 14, and Rebecca, Genesis chapter 25, verses 21 through 26, and in Samuel, 1 Samuel chapters 2 through 5, and so on. All experienced the happiness of having been visited by some heavenly beings just like Melchizedek, the king of Salem. But this seed from heaven was actually something quite normal in the ancient Orient. Every ruler had to be of divine descent, otherwise he wasn't worth a great deal. The Egyptian god Amun-Re mated with the mothers of the heirs to the throne. Alexander the Great, 356 to 323 BC, is said to have been conceived through a lightning bolt. The Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, 668 to 622, was the son of the goddess Ishtar, allegedly. Anyhow, he founded a magnificent library of clay tablets. The Akkadian king Hammurabi, 1728 to 1686 BC, also belonged to the heavenly births. His mother was made pregnant by the sun god. Hammurabi is known for the oldest written code of law, Hammurabi's Code. Religious figures such as Buddha or Zarathustra were also begot through a divine ray in the body of their virgin mothers, just like the founder of the Tibetan Empire, Gezer, or the first emperors of China. The same applies to the original rulers of the Incas and Aztecs. The motif is ancient, and we might say, international. In the Babylonian Gilgamesh epic, which goes back to Sumer, Gilgamesh, king of the city of Uruk, was created by the gods Shamash and Hadad. Thus, the great gods created Gilgamesh. 11 cubits high he was, two-thirds god, one-third man. It really becomes fantastical with the mutations practiced by the so-called gods on hybrid beings, the chimeras, which are said to have existed at least in the tales of the ancient chroniclers. They also begat human beings with two wings. Furthermore, human beings with goat's legs and horns on their heads, and still others with horses' hooves, and others in the shape of a horse at the rear and a human shape at the front. They also made bulls with human heads, as well as other monsters. This is how the church father Eusebius described it, who has entered church history as the bishop of Caesarea and as a chronicler, died 339 AD. Eusebius quotes extensively from the works of the Egyptian historian Manetho. He, in turn, is mentioned in the Greek historian Plutarch as a contemporary of the first Ptolemaean king, 304 to 282 BC. And what did Manetho Eusebius say? That there had been hybrid creatures of horse and human? The centaur says hello. Bulls with human heads. Didn't one of those live in the labyrinth on Crete? For us, rationally thinking people, there are only two alternatives with regard to hybrid creatures. All of it ignorant fantasy or genetic design. Logically, chimeras cannot have arisen naturally. The numbers of chromosomes of the monsters do not fit with one another. If they existed at any time, then only by artificial mutation of the DNA string. Who mastered this technique thousands of years ago? One can take the view that all these handed-down stories of heavenly births, divine kings, or hybrid creatures were a product of our ancestors' imagination. They wished for something like that. But that is too easy. The oldest writings come from Sumer, cuneiform writing, and a little later from Egypt, the hieroglyphs. The first scribes, who with some kind of stylus produced thicker or thinner lines on their clay tablets, were no science fiction writers. Writing was deemed to be a high art. Only a few mastered it. Yet in our time, we assume that these original scribes had entrusted fantasy tales to their clay tablets. I suggest that the rulers or high priests of the time would never have permitted such an abuse. The truth was communicated. Why on earth, then, did they write, "Thus the great gods created Gilgamesh, 11 cubits high, he was 2/3 god, 1/3 man. In our time, there have been new translations from a completely new perspective, and they produce a totally different picture from before. I have already referred to the translation by Dr. Hermann Burghardt. Dr. Burghardt is a specialist in Sumerian characters. He knows every root word, every cross-connection, every interpretation, and every previous work on the subject by his colleagues from the School of Sumerology. Now he has tackled the texts of the High Priestess Enheduanna. She scribbled cuneiform on many tables 4,300 years ago. Dr. Burghardt accuses his colleagues of sticking with the misapprehensions of decades. On the basis of these ancient texts, Burghardt proves the former existence of a space station in orbit. This space habitat was reached from Earth with a smaller machine, that in turn docked in a landing bay which closed like a trap. The previous translations, undertaken by honorable scholars, are shown to be erroneous because they start from false premises. Thinking in a different zeitgeist. In that far distant past of humanity, Dr. Burghardt says, it was not some heaven full of bliss which was sung about, not some meteorological phenomenon or natural disaster which was described. At no time was it about diffuse religions or psychological nonsense, but hard reality. The same, that is how I interpret it, applies to the texts about heavenly births and hybrid beings. Even if an extraterrestrial birth might have been imputed to many a king or religious leader after the event, some of these genetically modified forms did actually exist. They were intended to guide humanity, the masses, in a new direction. These mutations were created without exception by the alleged gods, the ETs. Why, for heaven's sake? And how can it be proved? The proof has to be provided by the geneticists, and it should not even be that difficult. But where is the recognized expert with sufficient courage to go public? As soon as even just one artificial mutation can be proved in the past, the same rules apply as do with regard to the SETI censorship. With such evidence, it is not just the existence of ETs that is proved, but also their influence on human society. In any event, I can confirm that these thousands of years old traditions repeatedly report about human beings who were conceived by artificial insemination. There is a clear statement of this in the Lamech scroll, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I have already reported several times about it. There we can learn that the seed of Noah was placed in the lap of Bat Enosh, Noah's mother, by the heavenly watchers. Now, and everyone knows it, we are all supposed to be the descendants of Noah. Never mind what name the guy might have been given in other cultures. This means that all of humanity carries extraterrestrial genes within it. What was that about the 68,000 differences between the human and chimpanzee genome? Yet this means that the amino acid sequence of the 231 discovered coded proteins in humans and apes varies by 83%. We are indeed products of evolution. But not only. Why, however, must an 81-year-old writer who is not a geneticist point out these connections in our society? Because I am familiar with the connections from traditions handed down in humanity, that is, what others are lacking. Also, some experts know very well what I know, but are not allowed to write about it because of their professional ethics. The mother of all questions remains. Why? What will extraterrestrials gain from producing intelligent human beings from an ape species, repeatedly making outstanding leaders over the millennia, showing themselves in the form of UFOs, or indeed creating magnificent pictures in our fields? None of that makes any sense. Where is the context? Have you ever thought about ants? There are about 13,000 different species, and worldwide, presumably billions of the little creatures. There are safari ants, which do not build any nests, but march about. There are myrmicinae, formicines, black and red ants, forest ants, bigger and smaller animals. There are said to be carpenter ants, or weaver ants, which build their nests from leaves. There are ant hills in trees and leafcutter ants, which break down leaves and carry them into the nest. Mainly in the Amazon, there are even mixed colonies that engage in a regular slave trade and make the ants they capture work for them. Then there are varieties, such as the white and red termites. All of them live in perfectly organized states with queens, soldiers, scouts, and workers. Normally, ant colonies are organized by castes. Each group is responsible for a different task, such as construction, food, parental care, or protection of the structure. The females actually establish the nests. They lay thousands of eggs. The rest of the colony serves to protect and bring up the young. The termites, particularly the dampwood termites and rhinotermitidae, are very inventive. Their structures consist of a maze of passages that lead toward the inside to the royal chamber and toward the outside to proper covered access roads. Ventilation in the building is perfect, neither too hot nor too cold. There are fermenting chambers, mushroom cultures, and even proper guest rooms. For certain types of ants, keep beetles as guests. They feed them and benefit from their secretions. Ant colonies engage in proper warfare against one another. Then scouts are sent out, and they spy and inform on one another. Treacherous attacks are commonplace. Foreign queens are disrespectfully cut into pieces, and workers are forced to work as slaves in the nest. This and many other things prove that there is a lot of experience in each ant state, but also memory and the ability to identify and communicate. Do ants know who or what humans are? Stand before an anthill and let the little creatures run up and down you. The ants will still not be aware of what a human is. This is how our memory, our technology, our consciousness works. The little animals can stare into our car headlights, hear the noise of our civilization, register our exhaust gases. They will still not recognize us. Gently place the animal into a glass, photograph it on your kitchen table, and then carry the ant back to its hill. The little creature will now run about excitedly calling out, "I was kidnapped by an extra ant intelligence." But all its fellow ants will, of course, know that there is no extra ant intelligence. The kidnapped animal is shunned, suffers from depression, and can no longer be happy. No one believes it. Even its closest friends turn away. "What were you thinking?" they complain. "Do you think you're something special? Even if there is some extra ant intelligence out there, why would they choose you in particular? They would have contacted our scouts or our queen directly." Can you see the scale of this? We humans could learn ant language in a special training program and teach them to consume other foods than they do at present. It would also be within our power to end ant wars. After all, each war leads to the torture and dismemberment of ants, suffering, exclusion, the destruction of nests, refugees who no longer have a home and fear for their life. Why don't we humans stop the ant wars? How can we watch such terrible slaughter without doing something? Because we don't care a jot about what happens in ant colonies. And the extraterrestrials in relationship to us? Quite clearly, they do care a jot what happens with us. They do observe our wars, although they have the means to stop them at any time. Have you forgotten the disabled intercontinental missiles of March 24, 1967 at the Flight Launch Control Facility in Montana? The ETs do not interfere in our politics, although they often smell to high heaven. They don't kidnap or punish dictators, or reveal themselves on public screens or above football stadiums. Indeed, they don't enslave humanity. So what do they want? Why the interest in us? The whole of the universe is inconceivably large, at least for human understanding. Just as astrophysics posits a Big Bang, or several Big Bangs in the beginning, so philosophy, or religion, likes to see an original God at the start. Plus and minus, yin and yang. The Big Bang creates matter, the original God, spirit or information. With regard to the Big Bang, we do not yet know with certainty whether the universe is expanding forever or whether it will, at some point, collapse again. Information, on the other hand, strives for infinitude until the whole universe is filled with information, intelligence. Every nook and cranny of space is to become divine. The exchange of information is to take place through all dimensions, periods, and parallel worlds. That requires the spread of intelligence. It has to infiltrate matter with spirit. This process takes place through the multiplication of intelligent beings. No intelligence exists without curiosity. It is the trigger of proliferation. That is why the original extraterrestrial intelligence makes sure that life can arise everywhere. That is how the universe is infected with the building blocks of life, the bewildering chains of molecules that only fit together like a key into a lock. Life, and thus evolution, arises on every suitable planet. From this, the most fantastic forms can in turn grow. Crocodiles, grasshoppers, dinosaurs, elephants, and birds. But evolution also knows mandatory forms. Only species with the right instruments increase intelligence. Thus, for creatures living in the water, it is impossible to invent electricity or the computer. Or metals can only be mixed with heat and turned into alloys. Furthermore, chains of molecules can only be made visible under an electron microscope, an impossible discovery for snakes or crocodiles. Evolution is full of mandatory developments. They are already contained in the building blocks of life. The development into apes was no accident. There was no alternative. Now, advanced extraterrestrial intelligences will probably have knowledge of more sophisticated astronomical processes than we do. They will know which suns are orbited by which planets, know which planets are in the habitable zone. Only now, after evolution has been at work for millions of years, are spaceships sent out. Not randomly, but to the specific places where life must have developed. When aliens came to our Earth, we already had millions of species, including our ancestors, the apes. The ETs caught a number of them, changed the base sequence in the DNA molecule, and implanted the mutated cell into the womb of a female chimpanzee. A fetus might also have been grown in vitro, in the test tube, as a test tube baby. After the gestation period, the female gave birth to a baby with the same skeleton, the same skull, the same physique, the same immunoreactions, but with additional hereditary factors that chimpanzees did not have. Curiosity, the capacity for language, equal information exchange. There was a sense of culture, such as for sculpture, music, painting, religion, and the most important of all, technology. From today's perspective, it made sense to screen the first humans from the environment and place them in a Garden of Eden. After all, the first humans, let's call them Adam and Eve, did not master any language. From their ancestors, they only knew grunts and sibilants. The language of the first generation of humans was the language of the gods. This assumption is today still reflected in the tradition of the Tower of Babel. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. The day came when the gods left for other solar systems to create further intelligence there. On their departure, the following might have happened. The first humans knelt before the aliens. The latter said, "We are no gods. We are of the same flesh and blood as you. Never create an image of God, because God is intangible and undefinable." The continuation of this imagined conversation can be read in Moses. "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. The instruction was clear. Intelligent life was to multiply and rule over non-intelligent life forms. But there was one crucial commandment that the first humans must never break. They must no longer engage in sexual intercourse with their non-intelligent fellow members of the species. This would have been genetically regressive. But it happened immediately. Someone carried on with a non-mutated fellow member of the species. This entered human memory as original sin. The calamity started. When the gods returned centuries later, it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. Genesis chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. The flood was decided, the experiment was abandoned, and a new one was started. The father of humanity after the flood was called Noah. Other cultures called him by different names, and he in turn was a figure begotten by the watchers in the sky. Since Noah, we humans are no longer purely earth beings. Changed genes are a part of our genome. Humanity grew, spread over the earth, developed various languages and cultures. The constant disputes between the groups led each tribe to develop its own weapons and better methods of defense. War may not be the father of all things, but the source of quite a lot of technology. Why were there wars in the first place? Could the ETs not have prevented them? The exchange of information among humans means that it was almost inevitable that different opinions formed. The independence of mind, the pride of human beings, led them to believe that only their own view was the correct one. The gods could have dissipated the tension and thus presumably created a peaceful, totally boring society. This, in turn, would have failed through laziness. In a life without tension, people seek to increase pleasure. This means their gray cells aren't exercised a great deal. We can invent something, but don't have to. I presume that this is what lies behind the long-term plan of the ETs. What is the first question in religious instruction? Why are we on earth? We are on earth to serve God and one day get to heaven. In today's context, the answer would be, we are on earth to develop technologies and spread intelligence throughout the universe. Why such complications? After all, the ETs already master the technologies and could spread them throughout space. They don't need humans for that. Imagine that the ethnologists of a highly technological society visit a tribe of Stone Age humans. Are they supposed to instruct them how to build a car? Writing does not yet exist in the minds of the Stone Agers. Mathematics and all other arithmetical functions are unknown to them. The establishment of the first school would be just the starting shot for the development of society. There are neither steel works nor a battery factory for power, No sign of wheels, tires, compressed air, gearboxes, cogwheels, suspensions, brakes, filters, steering, spark plugs, let alone oils and fuel. The ethnologist will not even attempt to teach the indigenous people how to build a car. The development into an industrialized state can only proceed in stages. That also applies to the universe. In space, millennia are not important. Imagine, further, that some intelligent species out there wants to know whether there are other intelligent beings within a distance of 800,000 light years. Do they broadcast radio signals on all imaginable frequencies? Get in touch. But radio signals are tied to the speed of light, which is about 300,000 kilometers per second. So do the astrophysicists of the intelligent species wait 1,600,000 years for a response, 800,000 years there and 800,000 years back? And all of this purely in the hope that an answer might come trundling back. It might be, after all, that there is no other intelligence within a radius of 800,000 light years, or one which does not want to respond. There is no way around it. In order to exchange messages and experiences in the vast distances of the universe, an information network has to be built through time and space. This is underway. We are meant to be part of it. The development into an industrialized society took thousands of years. Great-great-great-grandfathers found a way to mix metals into various alloys. Others tinkered around with plastics. Others had great fun with lightning and thought up electricity, off-road vehicles, tanks, aircraft, the atom bomb, and nuclear energy were developed. Industrialized nations arose, which today would certainly be in a position to construct giant spaceships. There are still knowledge gaps. Which rockets are the most effective? Does the warp drive from science fiction films exist? How is speed faster than light possible? The curvature of space. Do wormholes exist? Could spaceships fly through them? Even if these impossible scenarios were possible, even if ETs jumped around the universe at a speed faster than light, this does not change anything in the development of the cosmic information network. Societies have to be built in space and time, which are capable of all these impossible scenarios. That is why we are being given help from outside. Thanks to their knowledge, we are already in a position to build smaller UFOs. What did Benjamin Robert Rich, the director of the secret Lockheed Skunk Works department, say? We already have the possibility of flying to the stars. And the U.S. astronaut Ed Mitchell. Not all UFOs are in fact extraterrestrial in origin. Some of them are our own development. But we are by no means at the technological level of those who visit us. The ETs observing us neither want to kill us nor plunge the planet into panic. We are like them, created via chemical evolution to the Darwinian. As it is laid down in Holy Scripture, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them." Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Whereby only linguists know that the Hebrew word Elohim, used in the Bible for God, in truth is a plural term. The gods. Humanity has been watched over for thousands of years to the present day, including specific artificial mutations of some leading figures. Even today, you haven't forgotten, have you? Some ETs live among us. Some of the extraterrestrials look like us and could walk down the street without anyone noticing, proclaimed Theodore Hellier, ex-defense minister of Canada. Actually, quite a respectable model, says the opinion of one of my academic friends. But that's all it is, a model. Everything dealt with here could also be explained differently without the intervention of ETs. Correct. We humans can dissect everything. After all, it is a scientific maxim first to try the most obvious reasonable answer. And for that, we do not need ETs. Yet the judgment as to what is the most obvious possible answer is a question of the zeitgeist. Are UFOs a fact or not? Even with hundreds of thousands of erroneous reports, there remain a sufficient number of properly scientifically documented cases. Are pictures really created in corn and other fields that were not made by fakers and grow within minutes? Is there a group of 100 scientists who legitimately show that neither chemical nor Darwinian evolution was possible without outside influence? Scientists who want nothing to do with creationism or a belief in God? Do we possess traditions that are thousands of years old and tell about humans and animals created by the gods? Gilgamesh, two-thirds god, one-third man. The Lamech scroll with Noah's ancestry. There is more. Hundreds of cultures, from antiquity to the time of the conquerors, tell of the same independently of one another. All of them were visited by gods, instructed by gods, and there was artificial insemination. This claim I intend to document in the next chapter.